It's Dying to Ask First. We're interviewing a Deirdre.
Oh, man.
Yeah, you get two of us today, two for the price of one. Deirdre Walenick was a wife. She's a mother of two, a teacher, a writer, a musician, a marathoner. And at 66, she's now the oldest woman to climb El Capitan in Yosemite. She is also the Free Solo guy's mom.
Oh, is this the guy who did the super long El Capitan climb?
Yes, without ropes.
And then there was the Oscar and the documentary and all that.
Yeah, he's had a good year. Alex Honnold, the first guy to do that. So she has now written a book called The Sharp End of Life. And it's a climbing reference. The sharp end of the rope is the leader who climbs up above. It's the more dangerous of the people climbing. And it's really a metaphor for her life because she went through some stuff. And that's what she's writing about in this book. It started as a book about raising Alex Honnold, and it really segued and it turned into a memoir about her life, and then he's in it as well. And it really talks to the fact that we are all products of the way we are raised, and sometimes you don't realize that until much later in life. So on this Dying to Ask, what it was like surviving raising Alex Honnold, just some really good stories, her thoughts about the documentary, how it portrayed her family, where she was when she found out he'd actually pulled the whole Free Solo thing off, and then also why she then had to climb El Capitan in Yosemite, setting her own record for herself as a way to really understand her son. Here's a Deirdre on Dying to Ask. I'm Deirdre Fitzpatrick, and I am obsessed with knowing how people do things. I write the book, they start the company, they go from idea to reality. I call it the art of the follow-through, and I want to know how people go from A to B. This is the Dying to Ask podcast. Deirdre Walenick, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
And I know we should start talking about the book and your son and the movie, but can we first talk about being a Deirdre in this world?
Yes, let's.
Let's talk about, because we have some shared experiences purely based on our names, which are spelled differently,
yes,
but pronounced the same. Mm-hmm. One is, as a kid, I'll bet you never had anything with your name on it. You know how kids had like the little, have like a pen with your name on it or a bike plate or something like that.
Well, keep in mind that I grew up after the war, after World War II, and in an immigrant neighborhood, we didn't have such things.
Things like that, not so much.
They didn't exist, no.
Well, they still don't exist in this country for our names. That doesn't change.
Right, when you go into stores or like the national parks where they have all those license plates and things with people's names on them, never.
Never, I know. I always search just with hope, but I never find it. Nope. So let me ask you, before we get to the other stuff, I'm just dying to know, you grew up in a Polish family. How did you get the name Deirdre?
My mother just loved it.
Really?
Because we lived in an area that was totally, totally international. You know,
you grew up in?
I grew up in Jackson Heights. I started life in Manhattan, and then when I was three, we moved to Jackson Heights in Queens. And Jackson Heights has consistently been named by the New York Times, the most international neighborhood in the country.
Is that right?
Yes, and that's been for years and years now. And it's always been like that. The demographic changes, you know, waves come and go. But when I was a kid, it was after World War II, it was mostly European. Mm-hmm. Every possible nationality you can think of, from Europe and North Africa, a little bit of Asian, but mostly, and from the islands as well.
Sure.
You know, the Caribbean.
I lived in Queens as a kid, too. That's where I was born.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah, two Deirdres from Queens.
Two Deirdres from Queens.
That would be a historic day.
It could be a great TV show.
We should have a party.
Well, we like to think of the podcast as a party.
Whereabouts in Queens?
I couldn't tell you. I was six by the time I got out.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And then we moved on.
Yeah, Queens back then was like there was still farmland.
Oh, there was no farmland when I was there.
Well, you're considerably younger than I am. Yeah, when we moved to Jackson Heights, there was still farmland.
All right, so back to why we're really here.
Yes.
You have a new book called The Sharp End of Life, A Mother's Story. And it is a book, people might think it is a book simply about the achievement, some might say, of raising Alex Honnold, who, of course, we all know about after this Free Solo documentary that won the Oscar and has just captivated people around the globe. Mm. This book started off as being a book about him and raising him. But the truth is it turned much more into a memoir, right. And you're just referencing where you were born and grew up. And it's really interesting because it's a memoir about your life and then the impact that your life subsequently has, of course, on your children because that's
and
how
vice
life
versa.
Works. And vice versa. Yeah. So let me just start off by asking you, like, we all feel like we know your family after watching the movie. Did you like it?
In the movie, you only get to know the Honnold family, the husband's family. My family was back east. And so the kids didn't really know many of them, mm-hmm. you know, and didn't really get to know them deeply at all.
Yeah.
So that when you say we know them from the family, well, from the film, it's only the Honnold.
And I really mean your immediate family, your child.
Sorry. I thought you were talking about my family. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
But did you like the movie? Do you like
it? Did I like it? Oh, mm-hmm. yeah. It's an outstanding movie. They did a wonderful job with that movie.
Does it accurately portray what you believe is kind of the evolution of your son? In terms of the what yeah. he took on and what motivated him?
It does. It does. Yeah, I would say yes to that.
Because the thing I would imagine that you probably get asked the most about is how can you stand watching that? And you do address that quite a bit in the book. I mean, like, how many yes. times a day, once people make the connection,
yeah.
how many times a day are you asked that question?
That's usually the first question.
Yeah.
You're his mother. How can you stand it?
Well, you had some practice.
And I've been answering that for many years.
Many, many years.
But it also took many years to get to the point where I could understand and accept, you know, what he does.
When did it start to become really evident to you that he was wired a little differently?
At birth.
And honestly, you go into this in the book. I mean, like, from the
get-go. He was born with big, big hands, big, powerful hands, and powerful thighs. And when he was born, he could stand up.
That's such a weird thing to say about a baby.
It is. It is. People would come to see the new baby in the little bassinet. They'd lean over and say, and instead of saying, oh, how beautiful, or he looks just like you, or he looks just like grandma, everybody said, oh, what big hands he has. So I knew things were a little bit different, you know, right there. And there's a slideshow in the presentation I do, a slide in the slideshow I do of Alex on the swing set when he was two years old. It's pretty small, you know, not too capable physically yet. He used it like a trapeze. You know, he never sat and swung on it, whatever. He would always lunge and jump and grab and do heel hooks and do, he was different. He's definitely different.
I would say that's the understatement of the year.
Yes, exactly.
He definitely was different. And even after he achieved his incredible feat of free soloing in Yosemite, I get the sense that there were still a lot of questions with you in terms of trying to really understand him. And so one of the things that you sought to do was to connect with him in the world that seemed to talk to him, and that was through
his
climbing.
His own world.
Uh-huh. And so this book is really set. And I love the way you tell the story. It's set in a quest that you made after that to climb El Capitan yourself. And spoiler alert, you did it. And then you set a world record for being the oldest person to climb El Capitan.
Oldest woman.
Uh-huh. Oldest woman to climb
El Capitan. I didn't know that at the time, though.
You didn't know that?
No.
Oh, that's even better.
No.
At the age of 66, you did that. So that's the way the book is set up. It starts to tell the story. It starts with kind of like the movie. Like, I always say, like, when people watch that movie and they say they're so nervous about it, I'm like, you know, it turns out well.
Right,
so,
right.
And your book is kind of like that, too. You already know that, like, she pulls it off. But then throughout the story, you weave it chapter by chapter, talking about climbing, learning climbing, talking with him, learning all the things that have motivated him for so long. But then you go back to your story. And it really, to me, having consumed both of those in one day, I might add.
Which is page turner, isn't it?
Oh my gosh, which is a whole lot of Honnold for you. I have to say, like, I understand Alex now in a different way. Like, I look at his story in a different way. So let's start talking a little bit about you. You mentioned you grew up on the East Coast. You grew mm-hmm. up in a Polish-American family. Mm-hmm. And your family was maybe a little different than some other families.
Oh, yes, in many ways.
What are the ways?
Well, the most obvious physical ways, my mother had polio when she was young, when she was a baby. And so we learned very early on, like from babyhood, that when either parent spoke, when my mother called, you ran, you know, you hopped to it because she couldn't run after us. You take this for granted. Parents are always running after their kids, grabbing mm-hmm. them, keeping them safe, you know, stopping them from running into traffic, whatever. Our mother couldn't do that. So if she spoke, we hopped to it. You know, it was very different environment than most houses.
Yeah,
than most kids.
And your father?
He was a post-war kind of father. He was this kind of presence in the background. You know, he didn't really have much to do with kids. They both loved us, you know, they would have done anything for us, but they didn't really know how to relate to kids. And again, this is the Eastern European mindset. Children are to be seen, not heard. You know, kids go over there and play quietly, mm-hmm. and the adults will talk, you know. So it was a very different approach to child raising.
Was it very different than the other kids you would see in school?
It's hard to say yes or no to that because, yes, every house on our block, and it was a long block. Queens is, you know, nothing but blocks of houses and like 50 houses on the block. And in every house, they were from a different country, a
right.
different culture, a different way of thinking, a different approach to life, a different approach to child raising. So, yes, our house was different, and theirs was, and theirs was, and their,
right.
you know, they were all, everyone had their unique style
right.
of everything.
I ask that because I'm first generation. My parents are from Ireland, and I, you know, my father was a little bit similar to a little bit the way you described your father.
Yeah.
Not outwardly.
Kind of remote.
Just different. It wasn't touchy-feely, huggy-kissy like we are today, you know, and I related, actually, to Alex saying, talking about in the movie, talks about I didn't grow up in a real huggy house. I had to learn how to hug. You know, I'm not saying I didn't know how to hug, but culturally, people come to family in a very different ways sometimes.
Yeah. Well, that hugging thing, that was the Honnold family.
Right. You know,
my family was a huggy-feely kind of, but not my father much.
Yeah.
Men in general.
Just different.
I mean, he had been through World War II, like 5 years. He was over in the European theater, North African theater of World War II. He was just, it was all over for him, you know.
Yeah.
Both of my parents were very old mentally, you know, emotionally. They were very, very old. I think the war did that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
You write about how they had expectations of sons and daughters, like a lot of families
right.
at that time did.
And especially Eastern European families.
Absolutely.
And especially Eastern European families.
And expectation of the daughter was typically you'd get married and
right.
you would move to someone else's house.
First, though, you do all the chores.
Well, that.
You
that
are
is
the,
true.
You do all the chores at home. Boys were king. Yeah.
Boys were king. Well, you made a decision that you were going to make some different choices for
yes.
yourself in your
yes.
20s. And one of them was to move to California. And you
right.
had met Alex's dad mm-hmm. on a trip out here?
Yes. Yes.
And so the two of you decided to get married. And mm-hmm. so what were you guys doing in the early years before the kids were born?
We traveled a lot. He wanted to show me all of California. He loved his natural California, you know, the mountains, the deserts, all that stuff. And so we traveled every weekend. Every weekend we'd pack up the car and go camp or go hike or something like that.
And so when did you guys have the kids? You have two kids.
Yeah, I have two kids. After close to three years living in Southern California, that's where I moved to first, we moved to Japan. We were both teachers by then. I had already been a teacher, and then my husband got his degree. We taught at UCLA for a year, and while he finished his degree. And then we moved to Japan to teach English as a foreign language. And we stayed there 4 years. And during after 2 years, my daughter was born. Stacia was born there and spent the first 2 years of her life there. And Alex missed being born there by 1.5 months. I came back with my almost 2-year-old daughter and large with child.
Mm-hmm. And child with big hands.
Yes.
Yes. So Alex was born actually then in California.
He was born in California.
Okay.
Made in Japan, but born in California.
And so that's really kind of where I think that the part of the story that most of us are familiar with starts to pick
right,
up.
Right.
So let's take a quick time out. When we come back, we'll talk about Alex being born, him becoming what you describe as a playground pariah in the book, and what happened next. That's coming up next on Dying to Ask. Hey there, quick time out for a favor for your friend Fitz. If you are enjoying this podcast, and I assume you are because you're still listening, right?
Hopefully.
I hope so. Would you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, please? You can do it straight from the podcast app. Rate us by stars. Heads up. Five is the best.
The best. Our boss
loves the five.
Yeah.
Or you could write us a short review on what you like or maybe what you'd like to see in future podcasts. You write in the book, I wondered whether I would stay sane long enough to raise Alex. I think I would have wondered that too.
I wondered that every day.
You had two wildly different children.
Totally different.
So your daughter, Stacia, what is she like?
She's quiet and thoughtful. Of course, Alex can be quiet and thoughtful too. Not as often. But she was born a diplomat. She was a very sweet diplomat when she was a tiny baby, you know, and any other little baby that started, a toddler, you know, when they were walking, started to cry, she'd go over and pat their arm and tell them everything was okay or give them a toy. She just wants people to be happy.
And Alex?
The opposite. In just about every way, but they're wonderful friends. They always have been. They're enough alike, so that could happen.
How did you decide as a parent early to handle, like, knowing that, you know, your kid clearly didn't have what a lot of people joke as is the fear gene? And, you know, you write in the book about coming home and realizing he's up on the roof, and your way of dealing with it was to say, well, if you're going to be up there, you better clean the gutters.
That's right.
Why did you choose to go at it from that direction?
They were wonderful children. They were, you know, very wonderful children, both of them in their own way. And I knew people gave me a lot of advice about Alex. Alex was very physical. Oh, his only goal always was to get higher up. Wherever we were, if we were walking to the park, he'd walk on the wall, or, you know, climb on the train trestle or whatever to get higher. That was always his goal in life from babyhood. And so, but it wasn't mine and it wasn't Stacia's. So I knew there was nothing wrong with him, you know, technically, diagnosably wrong with him. That's just was his passion. That was his driving passion. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I got all kinds of advice, from mothers that I knew.
Is there anything worse than advice from other mothers?
Well, I mean, it was well meant, and they were trying to help me because I was haggard. Oh, mm-hmm. I was so worn out. I didn't get a single uninterrupted night's sleep for like 14 years. That takes its toll.
Yeah.
You know? And when he was a baby, he was not a baby, but a toddler. And from toddlerhood to like 5-ish, every day at 4:30 in the morning. Go play. And at 4:30, 4:40 in the morning, every day. Christmas, holidays, weekends. And he resisted going to sleep until late. You know, he just was unable to shut down. There's too much to do, and it's all too much fun, and he didn't want to stop. So I was totally worn down. And so they were trying to help me. They were trying to give me options, you know, to get some rest.
Were there any options that actually worked back then?
No.
No.
It's just the way he was. No, there were no options. And I realized this. I recognized that that's just the way he was. And it was nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. And that was his passion, and he wanted to go for it, which is great. And so they, you know, told me, no, put him on Ritalin, you know, you'll get some sleep, and take him to the doctor, get him diagnosed, and they can calm him down. I didn't want to just make him another version of their idea of normal. I mean, their kids, you know, they went out and played and ran around and stuff, but they played sports that their parents, I guess you could say, approved of or recognized or acknowledged as real sports. My son just wanted to climb, and that didn't fit their parameter of what was normal.
It's just different.
Different. Exactly.
Than what they knew.
Exactly.
Around that time, when your kids were small, you write pretty rawly in your book about the family dynamic at home. So you mentioned that your husband's family at the time, they all lived here. The Honnold family was in Sacramento,
most
Sacramento.
Yeah,
many of them anyway. And you write in the book about the fact that, you know, you were working a lot. You were teaching languages.
All the time.
Speaking French to the kids at home, writing.
I was a tour guide.
You started the West Sacramento.
Wrote for the Sacramento Union. Remember the Union?
Yeah.
You don't remember.
That's
it.
Even before my time.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But you also started something. You were very busy doing that. But the relationship with your husband wasn't the best that it could have been.
Right, putting it mildly.
How would you describe it? And what do you think was the impact just family-wise on you? Because the book really goes into the impact that had on you as well.
Well, it was like living alone. You know, I lived alone with the two kids, basically. I'm not going to go into the details here. I mean, he's their dad. They cherished him as their dad. He was a fun guy, and I'm not going to go into that. But it was like living alone with two kids. And I really mean alone, because for 5 years that we lived in West Sacramento, it was like living in a ghost town. You know, everybody, all the adults worked. And so there's nobody around during the day. All their kids were in daycare. There were a handful of us there. One woman ran a daycare, so she was there, but she couldn't do anything with me. You know, I couldn't go hang out with her. She was busy running her daycare. And I had maybe one friend, but miles away, so I couldn't just walk over there and have coffee or whatever. So I was alone, totally alone with the two kids. And the three of us had fun together. You know, we sang all the time, and we went for long walks, and we went on nature walks, and loved to draw, and we just had, they were wonderful people from the get-go, you know, from the outset. And I enjoyed their company tremendously, but I was exhausted all the time.
And it's interesting because around that time when Alex discovers climbing, and when you took him to the Rocknasium climbing gym, and there must have been a fear of, oh my gosh, what if?
Oh, I did want to take him there.
I bet.
Big way. But I was doing a book that called Sacramento with Kids, and I took my two to all of the things that I wanted to keep to put in the book to see what their reaction was. You know, did they like it? If they hated something, it probably wouldn't find its way into my book. And so I had to take them, get their evaluation. They were my test experts for everything. And I found out about the Rocknasium. I agonized over that for months. Oh, I can't take my son there. I didn't know climbing was a sport, an organized sport. I didn't know it could be contained, you know, like in a gym. I didn't know anything about climbing. All I knew was I had this little boy who did nothing but climb on stuff. So I, you know, in all conscience, I couldn't take him to a place that, like that. But I had to. And so I did. And yeah, it's a pretty funny scene in the book, I think. I mean, Alex knew exactly what to do when we walked in the door.
Yeah, and it just, pretty funny because, like, basically he disappears and then you look up.
Yeah, yeah. There were two young men who ran the place, and gave my two babies. They were 5 and 7, and Alex was teeny tiny. He was a little scrawny little kid, probably weighed 40 pounds by then. And so I gave my babies to one of them, and you know, they were going to put a body harness on them and let them try climbing and see if they liked it. And I was going to talk to the other one very fast. I had my list of questions. I was going to go really fast and get out of there because I had, you know, my mom's imagination was pretty fertile.
And accurate, as it turns out.
After a few years with Alex. Yeah. But, you know, then we were talking, and all of a sudden the whole gym went quiet. And I thought to myself, oh, my, this has something to do with my son. Because there's a lot of noise in the gym. People are shouting commands up and down. There's music playing. Everything went quiet. I turned around, and everybody in the gym was looking up at my itty bitty little baby who's 40 feet off the ground about to top out on this climb. And I didn't know what to say. I was totally speechless. And the guy I had been interviewing just looked up and said, wow, he's really good. I didn't even know what that meant. I didn't know anything
but
about
climbing. But he had found something.
But he knew. He knew what to do, and he knew how to do it, and he was good at it, you know, because he impressed all of those people that day.
Right. What is that like as a parent when you have a kid who's so tremendously talented in something that you have no knowledge of?
It can go one of two ways. You can step back and just be the mom and just let them go do their thing. Or you can embrace it and try to find out about it and try to make it part of your life as well. And that's the way I chose to do it. I wanted, because that was his whole life. I mean, as he grew and he started going out doing expeditions and climbing trips all over the country, all over the world, I wanted, when he'd come home and tell me about these trips, I wanted to know what he was talking about. I didn't speak the language. I'm a language person. You know,
you speak many
eight
languages.
I've taught 5 foreign languages, all, you know, many countries, and so languages are what I do. I didn't speak that language. He would tell me about things, and I didn't even know if that was good or bad, you know, what he was telling me about.
Because his career really, you know, in his teen years and early 20s, it really exploded. I mean, it I did. Remember covering, that Honnold kid just did this. And most of us, I mean, most of us didn't understand a lot of what was going on.
I didn't even know all that.
Yeah. No, I remember he was definitely on, you know, people's radars. But did you feel like it was really hard? You know, you mentioned like not speaking his language, but he had also found this whole other thing that sometimes almost feels like a family to you when you get so wrapped up in it.
Right. Right. Yeah. He had a whole... That's a good word for it. A whole family out there that I didn't know. And I didn't know them, and I didn't know what they did together, and I didn't know, you know, what they were talking about when they all sat around and talked about it. So I wanted to.
You wanted to. By the time he had done 1 year at UC Berkeley, his father had passed away of a heart attack. You had recently been divorced from him. Mm. And it was then that he said he wanted to go all in on climbing. I don't suppose he was asking for permission at that point.
He was asking for my blessing.
A blessing. And did you give it?
I suspect that if I had said no, he probably would have gone anyway.
Right.
Or he might have technically, on paper, gone back to school but not attended, you know. Because there was no way he was going to give up climbing, you know, and I knew this. And so I gave him my blessing. I gave him my van because I no longer needed the family van. You know, I had inherited my father also had just passed away, and I inherited his little car. It was all I needed. And Stacia now lived in Portland, and Alex lived on the road most of the time.
This is the initial initial van that,
so
of course,
it was just
everybody
me. So I gave him the van. I gave him my blessing, and off he went to make history.
And he did go make history. But then you did, too. And you did it while learning your son's language. So
yes.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about that. Do you love politics? Well, check out The Trail. Anyone who wants to be president has to go to New Hampshire first. This is a new Hearst Television podcast from our friends at WMUR-TV in New Hampshire.
How fun.
I know. The host, Adam Sexton, interviews all the people who want to live at 1600 Pennsylvania. And the way this 2020 campaign is shaping up, Adam's got a whole lot of episodes to record.
Oh,
you might have
man.
To help him with that. Check out The Trail from New Hampshire to the White House, wherever you get your podcasts. I read your book in one day, yesterday.
In one day.
One day.
And a page turner.
I know. And I also watched the documentary from beginning to end on a treadmill in one day. That is a lot, I'm going to tell you, to take in.
That is.
But I truly enjoyed it. And I think one of the most interesting things to me, at least in the documentary, is finding out how kind of low-key the actual day of Alex's record-setting climb really was.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is a lot of you who were closest didn't know it was actually happening that day. Where were you when you found out?
Well,
done it.
You have to understand first that Alex has done many, many free solos, you know, climbs without ropes in his, 20 years of climbing, many. And he never tells anyone that he's going to do a free solo. I don't think any free soloist would announce to anybody that they're going to do that because your mind has to be totally clear to do something like that, totally unfettered and... You know, if he knew that mom was sitting home wishing, I wish he wouldn't do this, that would cloud things up.
Right.
So, yeah, he never told anybody. But
so where were you when you found out?
I was on I-5. I was driving north to my daughter's house. It's a 10-hour drive, and I had just pulled over to a rest stop. And I was doing this drive with two friends from France, and we had just... spent the previous day with Alex in Yosemite, and he never let on, never said anything about that. He hiked with us, he hung out with us, and then we left. Never said a word. And then I was driving up I-5. We pulled over to a rest stop, and as we settled into our little picnic table, my daughter, I got a text on my phone, and it was my daughter, and she said, "Alex just free soloed El Cap," and that's how I found out.
And you thought?
Well, it was kind of overwhelming because by now I have a pretty good idea of what free soloing is all about. And so we stayed there for a while. I processed, and my friends kind of left me alone to process. You know? And then we continued driving up. It was a heady day. A really heady experience.
You had already at this point started kind of learning the language of climbing. You started going to gyms with him, and he started taking you. Once he started teaching you what he'd been doing all those years, what did you start to understand about him?
That could be a whole other book. How much time do we have? About him and about me and about life. And I mean, that's a lot of what I go into in my book.
You do. What are the big
ones? It's a learning experience from the very beginning and will always be, I think. Yeah, climbing reduces life to its essentials, basically. And I began to understand what Alex had been up to all those years, and I didn't understand how he could not talk about it with me. And I understood why he wouldn't talk about it with me, but he could have tried to make me understand, but he didn't. I guess he realized there was such a gap between what I knew and what he knew that there was no use trying to tell Mom about it. But once I started to climb, then I started to get it a little more, a little bit more, a little bit more. I still, after like a year or two of climbing, I still didn't quite understand what free soloing meant. I mean, I knew the words, and I knew. I think it was my mind was protecting me from, not letting me quite absorb what that really meant.
In some ways, as a mom, maybe that's good.
Yes.
Oh, don't yes, you think?
For sure. It's
just
a protective,
for your own self-preservation.
Absolutely. It keeps you sane. I mean, it's a strange thing to go free solo something.
At what point did you decide to take on the challenge of Yosemite yourself? In a very different kind of way. we should point that
Which
out and
challenge
explain
you
that.
Mean?
Well, your record-setting climb.
Oh, El Cap.
Yes,
okay. Because I've been climbing for 10
right.
years.
So at what point did you decide to do that?
We did a climb called Royal Arches, Alex and I. I have to preface this by saying every September, my birthday's in September. And so in September, the fall, and to a lesser degree the spring, but mostly in the fall, all the climbers, the elite climbers from all over the world, hang out in Yosemite and train on the walls. And my son is one of those, of course. So he's always there. I know he's always there. So for my birthday, I can always corral him into doing some extraordinary climb with me. And they're extraordinary for me, but they're baby stuff.
That's
for
funny because I just pick on like yard work at this point with a 13-year-old. I need to take it up a little, I think.
So, so each year he took me on something absolutely mind-bending. I've climbed all the classics, the most beautiful climbs in the world, some of them. But they're not hard. They're not technically hard climbs because I can do them. I'm not a very good climber. I'll never be a very good climber. I started late in life. I just don't have what it takes. But it's I do it. Moderate climbs. And after we did like 8 or 9 of these each year. I mean, this is a time intensive process. It took years to get to this point for me. And for him. And so we did a climb. I asked him to take me up Royal Arches, which is a technical big wall climb in Yosemite. A big wall means that it's vertical and it's very, very high. And it's so long, the climb, that a lot of climbers take more than one day to do it. They sleep on the wall, We were not going to sleep on the wall. Alex doesn't do that. Alex is up and down. Alex holds all the speed records in Yosemite. And when you go with him, you go really fast. And whether you can or not, I'm not a fast climber usually, but with him, I climb a lot better than I do with anybody else just because he assumes that I'm going to be able to do it. And on the way down, so we had to rappel down the front of this climb. So 15 rappels. It's very time-consuming. I had a lot of time to think. We're going down. And all the way down, I'll never forget, I was thinking, it's only dinner time. We did this in a very civilized amount of time, big wall. I wonder if I could do that other big wall down the road a piece in Yosemite, that other big wall that he was always talking about. Alex has been up El Cap, 50, 60 times, and always talks about it lovingly. And I watched climbers, watched the little dots going up the wall and wondered about, I wonder what they see from up there. I wonder what it feels like to be up there. And so here I was on a big wall. And so when we got down a few weeks later when Alex was home, I asked him just offhandedly. I don't think I actually expected him to say yes because I'm clearly not a big wall climber, but, you know, I don't have the strength. I don't have the knowledge of all the gear and how to – it's a long story, but you have to be really good to do El Cap.
And he
said, Alex, you think any chance that someday you might be able to take me up El Cap? And his answer was the same as every other year. Yeah, sure. It was always his answer. Yeah, sure. This one had a caveat, but his answer was always, you know, each year. Yeah, sure. And what he, after like three or four of these, I began to realize what he meant with that. I mean, his yeah, sure, it means sure. If you're willing to put in the time to learn what you need to learn, to get good enough to go do that, yeah, sure, let's go do it. So he said, yeah, sure, but you have to learn how to jug.
Meaning,
well,
for people who don't know,
that was me at that time. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what jugging was. Jugging is a colloquial term, climber term for jumarring or ascending the rope. I was not going to climb the rock, which is way, way too hard for me at this point. I was going to ascend the ropes. And when climbers climb El Cap, they do what's called aid climbing. It's kind of half and half. Sometimes you're on the rope and sometimes you're on the rock and you go back and forth. You have to put in gear. You have to pull out gear. Sometimes you have to jumar up the rope. And so, but to change from one state to the other, it takes time. And we were going fast and Alex didn't want me to have to change my shoes and change the gear and change the all that stuff, take my gloves off. So I stayed in one mode. I just jumared up the rope. So he would climb each pitch, attach my rope, and I would start jugging up, and the other person, Sam, would start pulling out the gear that Alex had placed on the way up. So that's how it happened. That's how we started.
And so when you achieved this incredible feat...
Thank you.
Seriously, dude, it's remarkable. What did he say to you when you were done? Because it's interesting.
Funny you should ask that.
Yeah.
Coming down... for me, was harder than going up, a lot harder, physically, mentally, everything. Going up was just jugging. I had that aced. I had to learn how to lower out sideways. Sometimes it's not just straight up. The rope would go straight up, but over there. And so I had to swing out and lower myself out sideways on that. And that was kind of terrifying because I had never done that anywhere. The only place you could do that is on a big wall. And I tried it once. So I wasn't totally prepared for that. But I knew the jugging part. I had that aced. And it was just a question of fatigue, really, on the top. And I didn't think I was going to be able to finish, but I did finish.
But you did.
But once you get to the top, it's like we were on the west end of El Cap. El Cap is kind of, you know, two sides. And we were over here, and the descent is way over there on the east side descent ledges. And so we had to scramble like a mile and a half up there. And I was totally exhausted. It was night. There was no moon. It was totally dark. We had just our headlamps, and Alex knew, you know, what condition I was in, and he talked the whole time. He told me stories about, you know, when he'd climbed with this guy and that guy, and showed me things, and once in a while he'd turn around and say, "Mom, I can't even make myself go that slow. And because it's hard. It's very glassy up there. There's a lot of glacial polish, which makes the rock very slick. It's walking on ice in spots, lots of stuff to clamber over, mm-hmm. and prickly stuff to avoid. And it was a marathon.
Do you think he got to understand you more through this too?
I hope so. I hope so, because it was a lot of work. I don't know. You'll have to ask him that someday. You know?
Well, we're totally up for that. You know, it's interesting. Like, a lot of people talk about fear when they talk about your son and what he did.
Yes.
What have you learned about fear?
Oh, goodness. Fear was a large part of of training. Mm-hmm. Not exactly training. My 10-year apprenticeship, if you want to call it that. The first time I learned to climb in the gym, and then they took it outdoors, up and down, we'd go all over the region. First time my friends took me on a multi-pitch climb where, you know, normally, like in a gym or out at the leap, you go up and then you come down. I can handle that just fine. You just stand on the ground, get tied in, you go up, you come down. A multi-pitch, you go up, and the next person comes up to join you, and then you keep going up, and you go up in increments. And the first time they took me on one of those, I didn't do well. I mean, I did it. I did the whole thing, but I was absolutely terrified. I got to the first ledge, and I turned around. We were like 100, almost 200 feet up. I turned around and looked out, and I was absolutely paralyzed. I couldn't help them in any way. They kept saying, Deirdre, hold this. Deirdre, I can't. So, yeah, there fear. Mastering fear was a huge part of my apprenticeship in climbing because I was mom. I was mm-hmm. trained over many decades to protect, you know, keep the kids safe. You know, watch out for that sharp edge. Watch out for that whatever. And then there I was up 200 feet, look down at, you know, the people. Looked like ants down there. And I was terrified. But you have to suck it in and just talk yourself. You have to learn to talk yourself out of it. And that's been a real lesson for me.
Let's wrap up by doing a few kind of mom-to-mom, Deirdre-to-Deirdre questions.
Deirdre-to-Deirdre, right.
Can't say that very often.
We were double-double, mom-tom and mom.
Yes, we're double-dipping here. The role, I always say, like, the role of a mom, your instinct is always to anticipate the worst that can happen and usually say no.
Right.
Because you want to protect your child.
Right, right.
What have you learned as a mother, especially of a mother of somebody like Alex, about the word no and about fear? What's your advice to
the
people?
The word no. We used to joke at home that until he was about four, we used to joke that Alex was going to think his name was Alexander No. Because that's all he ever heard from the adults around him.
I have one of those.
Alexander, no! And it wasn't funny, but it was kind of. I had to learn really early on which battles I should pick, which battles I was absolutely going to lose, and which were important enough to hold out on. Like, I mean, going up on the roof. I said no. And then one day he was up on the roof and I heard it. You know, I heard it through the house crackling. And I went out there and there he was having a great time up there and looking so comfortable. And so, okay, you want to go up on the roof? Okay. When you go up there next time, be sure to clean out the gutters. Anytime you're up there, you know, see what's in the gutters. But they also wanted, he and his sister, but I think he was the instigator, they wanted to tie a rope around the chimney and take it out over the pool to the tree in the far corner of the property.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, it does.
Until
it's not. On that, I stood my ground.
The challenge for all of us parents in knowing our children. Your child was kind of lost to climbing, that world.
Yeah,
A lot of our kids are lost to devices and to another kind of world.
Yes.
What's your advice to parents and what you've learned through your decades now as mom about making that connection with your kid and figuring out how to tap into what turns them on?
Well, you mentioned screens and stuff, devices. That's a very, very different kind of thing. That's a distraction, really, and a passion. That's not a... Now, let's backtrack. Very early on, you have to try to keep the kids focused. I mean, we did stuff together all the time. You know, we went out to the duck pond or taking walks or whatever, small children are kind of like puppies. The more you wear them out, the happier they are.
And help them find their thing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But once they do find that passion, if you have to decide whether you're going to embrace it or push them away. Because if you don't embrace it, it will push them away.
Yeah.
You know, you won't be part of their life.
The book is called The Sharp End of Life. It is actually a climbing reference. It's built in, the sharp end is. Mm-hmm. What is your big hope for your readers? What do you hope they get out of hearing your story and Alex's story, which is kind of buried beneath it?
What do I hope to?
What do you hope your readers get out of the story?
Well, the basic takeaway from this book is if you think you can, you can. And if you think you can't, you can't. It's life is really as simple as that. It's your choice. If you buy into other people's limits on you, you know, like when I was little, I wasn't allowed to climb because I was supposed to wear dresses and I hated it. And you know, the teachers at school, you know, at the college where I taught, they, you know, I would tell them what I did for the weekend when I was climbing. Mm-hmm. They'd say, Deirdre, you're crazy. You shouldn't be, you know, the shoulds and the shouldn'ts. They abound everywhere. Everybody has their idea of what you should be able to do or doing. There are so many. And if you buy into other people's limits for you, then it's not your life anymore.
If it's any comfort, I've heard, Deirdre, you're crazy, many times as well.
Oh, really?
Yes.
All right. Another Deirdre double.
Exactly. Where do we find the book, Deirdre?
Oh, you can find it anywhere you can buy books. You can be at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, IndieBooks, any reputable bookstore can order it for you. You can get it online, anywhere.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us. And how can we keep up with you in other ways? Are you on social media?
I am. Deirdre Walnick, at Deirdre Walnick, you know, not Twitter, the other one, Instagram.
Instagram.
and Facebook as well.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for,
sharing
your story with your kids, but also your story as well.
Thanks for having me.
You don't have kids yet. Mm-hmm. How would you handle an Alex?
That's a good question. I obviously went a different route, but I was that child.
Really?
Yeah. When I was a leash kid.
I was too. In New York City, I was a leash kid.
Yeah. So I became a leash kid.
I don't think you're supposed to do that anymore.
Right? They're backpacks now.
Yeah.
The way I became a leash kid was I was on the second floor of a mall, mm-hmm. and there was an airplane that was suspended from the ceiling. And I'm like, I want to go play on the airplane.
I can fly that.
So I had one leg already over the railing before my mom saw that I was about to jump off of the second mm-hmm. floor of the mall to get onto this airplane that I obviously could make the jump anyway.
That is awesome. Well, now you're in the dangerous world of podcasting.
Right.
Here we are. Hey, thanks for the ratings and reviews that have been coming in, especially on Apple iTunes. Big thanks to Leaded Coffee, like the name, who really liked the Debbie Gibson podcast and said, kudos on the podcast. Thanks for taking me back to the 80s.
Nice.
Rad. Love it. Keep leaving those reviews. You can follow the show on Instagram at Dying to Ask Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Run Read Sit.
I am producer Jeff.
Indeed you are.
Yep.
That's your podcast.
That's the
Instagram
handle also.
Handle.
It's easy.
Yeah, I know. Hey, thanks so much for all the support for Dying to Ask, and we'll see you again next time.
Bye.